One of the ways I've found to spark joy during this pandemic is always having my coffee out of a mug that is fun and whimsical. One of my favorites says it's probably not wine. Where did I get it? At the shop for Psalm TV merch. If you haven't been there yet, you must. There's so many great items there, from mugs to hats to tote bags to t-shirt. There's something for everyone. So check out shop.psalmtv.com. Thank them for sponsoring this episode of A Glass for Every Palate, and grab yourself something cool. All right, guys, welcome to this week's episode of A Glass for Every Palate. You guys know, if you follow me on social, how big I am about energy and people and things that spark joy. Well, our guest today has one of the brightest auras and smiles and energy. Like, you just want to be around her all the time. Our guest today, guys, welcome Sarah Thomas. Hey, Sarah.
Shakir, that is like the nicest intro I've ever had for anything. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
True. You are just a joy. You. You're so tiny, but like, you have such a big, you take up big space. And I love it. I love it. I love it. Not only with, you know, your personality, but just with the amount of knowledge you have and the things that you're doing. I'm so excited to have you.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
This is always like one of those backwards narration stories. Like, I bet you're wondering how I got here, right? So we know where you are right now, but we're going to go back in time a little bit to see how we got here. So you are a woman of South Asian descent. Were you born in India? Or were you born here?
No, I was born in Somerset, Pennsylvania.
Okay. So you are a U.S. born girl, but
yes.
You know, your physical appearance, it is clear that you have some cultural or ethnic makeup that is not purely just from the United States. So take us back.
That is right. My parents are both from Kerala.
Oh, okay. Is that southern India?
Yeah, that's the southwestern most state in India. So it's like a coastal state.
Ah, okay. Have you been?
I used to go every year, actually. Until my last grandparent passed, I went every single year.
I think that's the story of immigrants.
I loved it. We spent all whole summers there. Yeah.
That's the story of so many immigrant kids, right? Like, as soon as school is out, you're out.
Oh, yeah.
And I love that.
And we came back like right before it started.
I love that. And I think that it's a great way to keep, you know, the next generation still kind of rooted and grounded in their history and who they are. So Sarah's in Pennsylvania and she's growing up and she's, let's start at like college. Did you know what you want? Were you one of those people that like knew what you wanted to do or what you wanted to study or what you wanted to be?
Oh my gosh, no. I mean, I thought I did, right? I went to college young and I had this like, you know, somewhat stereotypical idea of like, okay, I have a lot of doctors in my family. My grandparents on my dad's side were both physicians, which was very uncommon for a woman to be a physician. And my grandmother was just like a powerhouse. And my father's a physician. And I was like, that's what I'm going to do. And so I started as pre-med, even though I like knew that I didn't really have a head for like numbers and like hard sciences. Like those were my hardest subjects. And I was still like, no, that's what I'm going to do. And I very quickly was like, nope, not, I can't do this. So I switched. I had a great professor who just inspired me. And I'm like you, I'm very attracted to energies. And she was just like my freshman comp professor, but she was also an expert in Renaissance literature. And I switched my major to Renaissance literature, English literature, and then and politics as well. And that's what I ended up doing with the intention of maybe being a professor, maybe going to law school. So like, short answer is no, I really had no idea because obviously I didn't do any of those things.
So how did we get into, let's start with how we got into hospitality before how we got into wine.
Sure.
How did we go from studying lit and politics? Well, actually the politics part makes sense, but how did we get to hospitality?
It's a funny sort of story because I actually continued along the literature track for a little while. I got my master's in English Renaissance literature. I was living in the UK for that. And at some point there, I was like, you know what? I'm switching back. I'm going to go back to pre-med because I can't remember exactly what it was, but I was like, no, this isn't the right track for me. I think I was right the first time. I think I'm service oriented. I think I have to go back to this. And so I decided to come back to the States and restart basically, and like do a post bac for med school. And while I was doing that, I was like, you know what? I've just been in solid academia for so many years. I just need to do something else. And in a funny, just like nexus of things, I happened to have written my dissertation on a metaphysical poet who was also, he was a physician as well as a poet. And like, he had all these like crazy medicine books that he came up with that were, you know, every medicine in the Renaissance was like basically just alcohol. This like overly romanticized notion that like, all right, if I'm going to have a job, like, let me like connect it somehow to what I've been doing. And you know what? I'm going to make cocktails. I'll be a bartender. Like, that's literally what it was. It's as okay. silly as that. And so I came back and I was like, while I'm studying, I'm also going to try and be a bartender. And I had a real like fake it till you make it attitude. Like I walked in and I was like, yeah, I have tons of experience. And like didn't, obviously. I had no idea what it was like to work in the industry. And that showed pretty quick. But I was like really tenacious about learning. Got super into, like, there was something about the lore behind, you know, cocktails and spirits and all this stuff that like really attracted the academic side of me. And then I just like really started to thrive in a service situation. Like, I loved curating these experiences. Like, I had this very romanticized look at what I was doing in the restaurant. Like, you know, I felt like theater, it felt like teaching, it felt like I was really like gathering all this knowledge and being able to share it. And it really felt like a light bulb was going off for me. And I didn't know anything at all about wine.
That's such an interesting parallel. I mean, I was on a Clubhouse chat and we were talking about like missing things, simple things like that, like walking into a really good cocktail bar and being able to like have that conversation about what your day was and what it puts you in the mood for. But for me, the memory and all of that was like, you're going to get a good cocktail when you walk into a bar and it basically looks like an apothecary when you walk in. Like, there's all these bottles of things. It's almost like, oh, I'm going to get a potion made for me. So I can totally
That's literally what it felt like. That I was making potions.
I see that parallel and that makes so much sense. Okay, so but that all ties into like the whole trajectory is making sense. So how do we move from cocktails to wine? Because I think I'm interested. Yeah, I'm going to reserve what I'm thinking.
Yeah, it was another energy thing. At the restaurant where I started, which was this amazing restaurant in Pittsburgh called Spoon, which sadly closed last year, there was a sommelier there. I literally didn't know that a sommelier was a thing. Until I met this woman, and she was like formerly a corporate lawyer and left her job to be a somm. And it was like, I was just like, what is this job? Why are you so cool? How do you know all this stuff? Like, what? And it was the same thing with like the professor in college. I just like was like, I just kind of want to impress you, you know, like I just, and so I just started learning. I started learning about wine. And then, I still don't think I had the like spark for wine itself. I think I was still like, I just want to impress this person. And then a friend was opening up a restaurant in Pittsburgh and was like, I can see that you really enjoy this. You know, I didn't know it at the time, but he and, you know, his partners had like, we hung out a lot and he'd been opening really great bottles of wine for me. And I had no context for them, no idea. So I was just really experiencing this wine very honestly. Very naively. And I loved it. And he one night was like, I really don't feel like working this dinner that we're doing. It's a private event. I know that you can like, you know how to do service. And if I just tell you what these wines are, can you learn something about them? And can you do this dinner? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. So I went in. The wines were, the two that I remember were Arianna Acapinti, SB68 Bianco, and Marie Noëlla Drew, her non-vintage champagne. And you know, the Ledru is like a lot harder to get now than it was then. But the Acapinti is still pretty readily available. And I remember diving into both of those, like learning about them before I ever tasted the wine. And then I tasted the wine and I just had this whole like fall into the glass moment where I said like something clicked. And I was just like, I love this. And like, there was, I didn't know anything technically about tasting wine, right? I was really just experiencing it. And that's a, I think that's like the honest moment where I was just like, I love this. I want to do this forever.
There's so much in that. Like, one, I think that if we can bottle and sell those moments, right, where something just clicks to you and that spark ignites, like that would be hands down the most world-changing product ever that we can sell. And two, what you described is so important. And I think today, even with getting more people and a different group of people into wine, there's a difference between like academically tasting wine and then experiencing wine. And I think that all too often, professionals and the culture makes it more about tasting wine than it does experiencing wine. And that's where the joy is. Like, you don't have to try to entice anybody to enjoy the experience. You just have to give it to them once and they'll want to go back for more. So I love that. Like, I think we need to...
You're so right about that.
We need to add that. Like, it needs to be about experiencing wine because that's what you'll remember more than anything else. Like, you can remember facts about it, but you can always Google the facts, but that feeling when you're experiencing it is very, very different. Okay, so then you decide you want to dive into this. So do you immediately like look into, I know this about you and your story tells it that you're just a person that likes to study. And I love meeting my fellow people that are just people that enjoy constantly studying and learning about stuff. So did you immediately start looking into like, okay, if I'm going to do this, how am I going to, like, what do I need? What's the academic background I need for this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I basically was like, okay, how do I make this official, right? And to me, like, official meant like having some sort of certification or degree or whatever. And so like right away, I found the court and I started studying. And I was like, I'm going to just pass all these tests. That's what I'm going to do. Because that's how I measure success for myself is like, can I pass this test about it? Which that I've evolved in that thinking. But I no longer really, I'm not really pursuing any of those accreditations anymore. But at the time, it really felt like that's what I needed to do. And honestly, it's what I wanted to do. I wanted to feel like I earned like the space that I was in. And I felt at the time, like having these like academic accreditations would give me some sort of like authority where I really like didn't know if I deserved it otherwise. Like I wasn't sure. It was kind of at the time it felt like, you know, if you're just like really excited about it. Like, who am I to tell someone about wine if I don't have something formal behind it? I didn't feel like I had earned that authority. So that's what I did. I just studied a lot.
And it's so interesting how like culture has shifted, right? Like if you go back 60 years and you don't look like us, let's put that little asterisk in there. But if you go back maybe 60 years, you could literally... bachelor's degree, no degree, you could work your way up from like the mailroom to the C-suite, right? And then something happened where that was just no longer possible, where there were steps ordered that to get to this level, you had to do this, this, and this first. And we convinced people that exact thing, that it doesn't matter what you know, if you don't have this piece of paper or this accolade or these letters behind your name, you are not in a position to teach anybody about it. And I love to see that culturally we're shifting away from that again because access to all those things are a privilege that we all benefit from in some way, shape, or form, but it's extremely restrictive to a lot of people. So I applaud you for like recognizing that and to speaking truth to it, like, particularly being women, like that was almost instilled, right? In that, like, in order to get respect, you've got to have this, this, and this. And we bought into it. And I'm happy to see that we're shedding a lot of that. Okay, so now you've studied, let's go to certified. What was your first, like, job as a sommelier?
So the that group of friends who opened a restaurant and like were like, hey, can you just do this dinner? I became the sommelier and then beverage director at that restaurant that was called Bar Marco, also in Pittsburgh. That was a pretty quick jump and a very steep learning curve. I still am not sure how I like that became a thing, but it did. And so that was my first on job. And that restaurant had a very different ethos, which is, I think, way more commonplace now, but definitely was atypical in Pittsburgh in like 2012, whenever I started there. And it was like super, super natural wine, like all natural wine.
Really?
Yeah. That was my intro. I mean, like we drank a lot of like what we now refer to as like classic wines. But the wine list was super natty. And at the time, like there really wasn't a lot of that. There wasn't any of that in Pittsburgh. And there wasn't like, that was starting to become a thing kind of everywhere. So I felt like we were ahead of the curve a little bit there, but it was a weird knowing like now what I know about wine and having worked at La Verdadera for so many years, like it was a very weird, like sort of backwards entry point into like the broad world of wine. Like I couldn't have switched harder when I moved to New York.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, we got to talk about that change. So you are at this restaurant, super funky wine list that is like funky ahead of its time. And you decide, do you just want more? Do you want to like, what brings you from Pittsburgh to La Bernardin?
I mean, it was as simple and as complicated as I can't like take a vacation without like feeling like I got something out of it. You know what I mean? So like there was this weekend, I was taking a long weekend where I was visiting friends in New York City. And I was like, well, since I'm going to be there, like let me reach out to some Soms and like see if I can get some advice and maybe stage somewhere. So I had reached out to our good friend, Dustin Wilson, who at the time was at 11 Madison Park. And I was like, hi, can I stage at EMP? Like, cause I didn't know anything. And
I love that, like, that a part like, of your vacation plan was to stage at a restaurant. I just want to point out that that's normally working for free in a restaurant is not a part of anyone's vacation itinerary. But
I was real addicted.
I love it.
I was really in. I was like all in on just like, you know, trying to be better. And like, I couldn't stop. I was like, this is an opportunity. When am I in New York? Like, let me ask. And obviously I could not stash at EMP because no, but Dustin was kind enough to meet with me and he gave me some great advice. And I also on the same trip happened to meet, Aldo, which was a complete, like, that was unplanned. My cousins actually took me to La Bernardin for dinner, which was like the nicest thing ever. We sat at the bar. I didn't know that they knew Aldo, but he came over to chat and I was like starstruck. So I wasn't speaking. I was like kind of drunk too, because we'd had a bottle of champagne before coming to La Bernardin. And then my cousins told him that I was a sommelier in Pittsburgh and he was like, oh really? And, poured me blind tastes for like our whole dinner, which was like terrifying. Like terrifying. And you know him, and like we know that he's just like the most lovable dude, but like when you first meet Aldo, he can be like pretty intimidating. Like he just has a very steady gaze, you know, and like and I was just like, oh my God, why is this happening to me? but at the end of it, he was like, all right, so what are you doing with your career? Like, what's going on? And I was like, I don't know, like maybe I'm going to move to Philadelphia. And he was like, okay, if you're going to move, like, why wouldn't you move to New York? I had never considered, living in New York. The city like sort of scared me. He was like, if I offered you a job, would you move here? And I thought he was humoring me. But he wasn't. And I like followed up with, like, he was like, I'm serious, email me. And I emailed him the next day and I was like, were you serious? And he was like, yes, come in for your interview.
Oh my God.
And then I got a job. So I came for a vacation. I ended up getting a job and deciding to move to New York within like 24 hours of all of that. And that's what I did. I just jumped in.
That is awesome. One. And it's just, you know, I think that it's really important to recognize that, like, you never know when opportunity is going to knock. So it's really important, no matter what we're doing, to just keep some flexibility to what you're doing, right? Like, I have a podcast. If you asked me this question last year, I might have laughed at you because what do you mean? No, I'm not having a podcast. That's a lot. No, no one's going to listen to it. I'm going to have a subscriber. It's going to be my parents. And no. But, you know, like when someone presents an opportunity to you and you're like, wait, are you serious? Yeah, I really don't think I know what I'm doing, but let's do it. Like, let's see what happens.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing.
I love that spirit. So did you started at, so people not in New York, La Bernardin is kind of on the street and there's a little, what's that called in the middle? A plaza? What would you call the
Yeah,
section?
I guess so. Atrium? I don't know.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Something like that. between yeah. where La Bernardin is and where Aldosson Wine Bar is. So you started at the wine bar, correct? Or did you start?
Yes, so I was on the opening team at the wine bar. And then I was there for like 9 months-ish and then moved over to La Bernardin.
How was that?
Terrifying and really
hard. Because it's a very different vibe.
Very different vibe. I mean, even the wine bar, like I'm so grateful that Aldo started me at the wine bar because, you know, the combination of like moving to New York and finding an apartment and working the hours that we work, you know, in the industry, like, and all like figuring out the subway and like sleeping for 2 hours and like we stretch all the stuff was just that plus La Bernardin would have been too much for me, I think, to start. And so I'm really grateful that I did start at the wine bar. Even that pace was really hard for me. It was a very steep learning curve. I feel like, you know, the right way for me to learn, I know this about myself, is to really be thrown into it and just like do it. And that's exactly what happened. And so, you know, I kept studying, I kept working. I struggled for sure. The first month I was just like really sad and really like, it was really hard. But it just, you know, I got it at some point. Like I felt I got into the rhythm. Like again, there's always like a click moment for me where I'm like, oh no, I'm good at this. Like, I can do this. Like, it's almost like I felt like I hadn't earned my place there yet. And then suddenly I was like, yes, I did. 'Cause I'm doing it. And it was great. And, you know, and after 9 months of that, switching to La Bernardin was similarly hard, but at least I had like energetically, I knew what I was getting into. I'd been primed for a little bit, although it had me work like auctions and private events in the La Bernardin manner before I actually started on the floor there. So, you know, I was a little bit better primed for that, I think. And I was just like, I'm not making mistakes. Like, I'm not going to fail. Of course I made mistakes, but like, that was my attitude going into it, was like, I'm all in. Let's go. I need to make sure that like nobody has any reason to think I don't deserve to be here.
Right. Wow. And I mean, La Bernardin and fine dining culture is so, it's weird, right? In that, like, if you're in it or you do it, you love it. Like, there's so much to love about it, right?
It's a real rush.
it really is. Like, I miss going out and having, like, I like to cook, but the reason that I love some of these restaurants is because, one, even if I was to cook this at home, it would take me 8 hours and would cost me $300 in ingredients. So I am better off just paying someone to do this for me. But it's artistry. It's technique, it's science, it's just everything about it is, it's almost a performance to watch and to experience, like a live immersion experience, which I love and miss, but it's also very much a stuffy culture, more so the guests than the restaurants most times. And it can be quite intimidating. And even as a guest, I mean, I cannot begin to count the amount of times where I've been the only person dining that looks like me. And you do have that. Like, I'd be lying if I said I didn't have these moments. Like, are people looking at me? Like, what's she doing here? Who's she with? Who invited her? And then I remember, wait, the check is going to come and it's mine. I belong here. As long as I'm paying my money,
That's
I'm
right.
going to enjoy this experience. But I want to ask, like, what are some of, like if you had to summarize the best and the worst, not specifically of Le Bernardin, but because you've also worked like private dinners and auctions and are familiar with that culture, what's the best and the worst of fine dining? Like, let's separate that out. What's the best and the worst of it to you?
Wow, that's a big question. I think there's a lot of bests and a lot of worsts, if that makes sense. Like, I mean, I'm maybe cheesy in like saying this, but like I really did feel intense like personal gratification whenever I knew that I had played a part in someone having a great night. And what I loved about Le Bernardin is like people were there because they want, like, okay, most people were there because they like wanted to have a great night. And so the energy was already there. Like it was starting in a good place. You know, and then I just, you know, I could just improve it really. I could just like, you know, and that always felt really good. So like, even if I was having a really difficult night or had a difficult table, like all it would take would be like one really great table that was really happy to be there to really turn my mood around. And I miss that like adrenaline rush of like immediate gratification of success, of like knowing I did a good job. And you get that in service. And like the opportunity to like introduce people to new things and talk about this stuff like to the extent that they want to talk about and like feed off of that energy. And like I learned a lot from my guests too. I think that's the best, right? Like the guest interaction, like learning from and giving to people. I really feed off of good energy like that. The worst, I mean, it's like, it's anything else, right? Like some people are just like there to be miserable and make other people miserable. And like, you know, that's not fun. It's like when people feel entitled to experiences, it's very different than when people are excited to experience them. And that the sense of entitlement, not just at Le Bernardin, just like in general, I think like when people go into things with really outsized expectation of like what they deserve out of it, it's very hard to meet that sometimes. And like, how can you help fall short of it if people are energetically behaving that way? So, you know, sometimes you'd witness that in different scenarios, and that was kind of demeaning, demoralizing. You know, I could tell when people were looking at me, sort of like how you mentioned, like, what is she doing here? And like, how is she the authority on wine? I could really tell that. It was rare that someone would like say anything at Le Bernardin, mm-hmm. but
you could feel it.
And I could feel it more often than it was actually said. But so that wasn't great. And then sometimes when you're dealing with just like, you know, when you're dealing with like luxury goods, you know, I think a lot of people feel this. It's like, sometimes you're just like, what am I doing? Like, what is the point? Like, these are just really expensive things that I feel very lucky to like interact with, but it's not like I could never afford it. And like, sometimes you see people like taking it for granted and you're like part of the process and it doesn't feel great. So there was, you know, a little bit of that, but I think all of that was more like, I think overwhelmingly, like that was less bad than the really good stuff that came out of the experience.
Yeah. And I think the fact that you can realize that, feel what you feel and then calibrate it back is what kind of keeps you healthy in those spaces. I mean, I think there's something wrong with people that take pleasure in, how do I want to phrase this? Let me think of the most politically correct. No, I'm not. I think that there's something wrong with people that take pleasure in like subjugating people that are working in service, because service doesn't equal servitude or subjugation, right? So I think there's something wrong inherently with people that do that, and you see it everywhere, right? I mean, how many times have you seen somebody like yell and go postal about their coffee order being wrong? Like, it's a cup of coffee. Like, I get it. You need this right now, and your day is shit, and this is really going to turn it around, but you had to calm down. Like, it's not that serious. So ever the learner, ever growing, here you are, you've got this amazing position that you actually love in one of the best restaurants in the world. And there's something else like nipping away that you start thinking about, and Kalamata's Kitchen is brewing in your head. How does that start brewing?
Well, so I felt there was a point where I felt like I was really comfortable at La Bernardine. And that's one of those things where I was like, if you told me that when I started there, that there was going to be a day where I was like comfortable and like happy in my skin and like able to just like work the floor with ease at La Bernardine, I would have laughed in your face. Like I would have been like, nope, that's not happening. This is terrifying all the time. But there was a point where I was like, oh, I'm just really comfortable in this position. I feel like I'm good at it. And as soon as I feel like I'm good at something, that's where I'm just like, well, I need to do something else then, right? And I was looking for like ways to get back into writing. I was considering like doing some wine writing, but nothing was like really, it wasn't like really exciting me that much. And then my dear friend, Derek Wallace, actually came up with, he called me one day and he was just like, I have this idea. I think it's a good idea. I think, you know, you might really like it. Do you want to hear it? And I was like, yep. And basically he'd come up with this. he knew I was looking for something. He knew I loved working with kids. I mean, for years, I'd always loved volunteering with kids. Every time I went to India, I worked in a school for intellectually handicapped children. And like, I loved working with kids. I loved writing. Derek knew all this about me and like was able to thread the needle. And he came to me with this idea of like, he was like, what if we could create the character that people associate with food adventures, and this is for children. What if we get to introduce children to the world through food? How would we do it? We'd do it through a character. Do you think you could bring the character to life? And I was like, this is the best idea I've ever heard. Yes, I can. I think I can. Maybe I can. So we kind of dove in. Like we just spent a lot of time thinking about what we wanted the world to be, how I'd experienced the world through food, how Derek had, in very different ways. Like he really started to experience the world through food as an adult. I had grown up in, you know, in a culture, again, the South Indian culture, where food is like the center of our universe. It's like all we talk about, like we're eating a meal and we're talking about the next meal. And, you know, and so we were like, how do we combine like the magic of our like experiences into this world? And so that's where Kalamata's Kitchen was really born. It was born out of this idea of just wanting to like expose children at the earliest that we could to all of the wonder that food and like all the possibilities really that food have introduced, you know, all the stuff that like food did for us, basically.
Yeah.
And so that's where it came from.
I mean, you know how excited I was about this project, because for the longest time, like I agree that music is a universal language, but I think that food really is as well. And I think a very, very good way to start introducing children to culture and to the rest of the world and to broaden their horizons is through food. Like kids are picky eaters to begin with. So why not throw everything but the kitchen sink at them, you know? And
exactly.
You guys follow me, so you know. I mean, it's been a year without Sydney and our regular adventures, and I miss her dearly. But even as before Kalamata's Kitchen came out, like that's exactly what we did. Like Saturdays we'd go to ballet class and then it was going to be lunch somewhere, right? And sometimes she's like, no, I don't like sauces. I don't like green things on my food. I don't like any of it. And so, all right, fine. Then let's decompose it. Let's taste each piece of it and let's see which part of it you like and which part of it you don't like, right? And then let's talk about what you don't like about it. Like, why don't you like it? Is it the texture? Is it the taste? And like, kids are not beyond understanding this, right? Like, they'll actually be quite descriptive about what they don't like. And it's just such a cool way to help kids experience culture and introduce them to things. And I think that the whole concept of it is brilliant, and that a lot of kids will benefit from it and will have better diners when they're older.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's a huge part of it, is like, I think that the earlier you do this, introduce kids to this kind of world and being more mindful about what they're eating, and as you said, why behind a like or a dislike is so important. I think a lot of adults can benefit from this too, right? Like I've applied a lot of the like assessment techniques that I have from wine in terms of like breaking down flavors and scents and textures and And I've tried to like translate that into like, how do you talk about this stuff with your kids? And what we've realized is like a lot of people, the same way that a lot of people sort of lack the confidence to speak with a wine vocabulary, a lot of people just lack the confidence to speak about a sensory vocabulary in general. And so, you know, that's why these conversations don't happen a lot of time, is like people don't realize that like that vocabulary is part, for me, it was always part of the experience of eating, is like thinking about those specific things. And so we're just really trying to like remind people to like dive in. Like, why is this delicious? Why don't you like it? What does it feel like? What does it sound like? What does it smell like? What does it taste like? Everything, like experiencing stuff with all of your senses is such a great way to like get the most out of whatever you're eating or drinking, but B, to like remember it, right? Like you're creating an experience for yourself when you pay attention to that level of detail. And kids like assessing stuff like that, right? Like they ask why all the time. And this is just sort of flipping the script and making sure you're asking them why. And it's really fun. It's really fun. Like you get to, we basically just like sort of made trying new things an adventure, and adventures are fun. So therefore trying a new food is fun. And so, you know, we have what we call our, I think like really it can all be summarized by what we call our taste bud pledge, which is I promise to keep my mind open and my fork ready to try each new food at least two times and to share what's on my plate when someone doesn't have enough. And that I think encompasses what Kalamata's Kitchen is really trying to do, which is introduce the ideas of curiosity, courageousness, and compassion to children through the act of eating, through the act of trying, through the act of experiencing new cultures, and then also being able to share that experience with other people.
Oh my gosh, that is so like everything that would help the world, like on a global level, right? Particularly the sharing, because somehow we forgot that, right? As kids, everybody would be like, oh, you don't have it? Here, use one of mine. And then as adults, we're like, oh, you don't have it? That's your problem.
Yeah.
So ridiculous.
Yeah. And all of it leads to something else, right? Like curiosity, I think, leads to empathy. Like when you, mm-hmm. And so all of it, all of that stuff leads into something else. You know, you have to be curious enough to want to try something new or to meet a new person or to, you know, like anything. You can extend it out, but you have to, once you have that curiosity to want to try something, then you have to have the courage to do it. Then you have to have the compassion. Then that, I think that all of that builds compassion and empathy for other people. And I think that's so important to drive home for children so that they don't, like, how do we drive it home so that what you just said, that we don't lose it when we get older? And I do think that sharing food is really the best, like, global handshake that we can do and build that, like, lifelong love.
I love it. And then you're partnering with other great people. We saw Eric make an appearance. Actually, two Erics now. I'm super excited that you tell us about that partnership.
I mean, so we work with a lot of just amazing chefs, right? I've been just humbled by how much the like food world has sort of embraced Kalamata's Kitchen. While I was at La Bernardine, we had done two independently published books up to that point, and went up to the point where I had always given like the first copy to Chef Repair as like a thank you for like letting me like do this while I was also working at Renan. And I remember giving him the second book, and he was like, "This is great, but like, when am I going to be in a book?" And I was like, "Wait, really?" It was really sweet, and I was, because I never wanted to take advantage of that relationship, because like,
right,
he's, you know, still my employer. And so, but then, you know, that it felt like that was okay to do at that point, because he asked. And so he was a really big part of our company growing. And so from that point, you know, we did the third independently published book with him. That's what we had presented, you know, to Penguin Random House. And so the next books that will be coming out will be with Penguin Random House. But in the meantime, in kind of like in the middle, we were like, okay, chefs really like this. We really love sharing the stories and perspectives of our own food heroes. Let's reach out to everybody that we love and see who's in. And so you saw, you know, recently Eric Ajapong had a story snack feature. Kristen Kish had a story snack feature. You know, it's just like the coolest, like people that I really idolize found something in this that they could really relate to, saw a need in a way in their own audiences that, like, everybody wants more kids and families to come into their restaurant. Everybody wants, you know, everybody wants to be able to connect that way. And so we're kind of providing that connection point, you know, the way for them to reach this family audience. And more importantly to me, I think, is like, I believe very strongly that the stories and perspectives that they provide us are so important for people to hear. And you don't often hear in like the interviews with like Top Chef alums and stuff, like you might hear about, you know, the inspirations for their restaurants, but I'm really interested in like the what in their childhood like sparked this joy, like what came from and what lessons from that, and what do you remember that could like really spark it in another child? Like, what do you, I always ask these chefs, like, what's the one lesson that you've learned through food that you've carried through from like childhood to now that you think is most important for kids and families to know? And it's always so profound and wonderful and helpful. And like, I'm just super grateful that people have been so excited to share their perspectives with me. And I hope that, like, I have the best job on our team. I basically just get to talk to cool people all day and like write their stories and share them.
Girl, same.
It's amazing. It's amazing. I can't, I'm the luckiest.
That's really what this podcast is about, right? Like, you know all these names in food and wine and culture. You know them for who they are today. But when you talk to them about like how they got there, you know what I mean? It's so less, it sheds all of the intimidation that surrounds everything. And you understand that it's just, it can be for you too, right? It's just the spark. It's just the combination of the right thing at the right time in the right environment, and you're hooked. I love it. I can't wait to see how many more collaborations we have coming. I mean, Sydney has took me a smooth 35 years to get to Michelin star restaurants, and she got to eat at one before she was six. So geez, you know, the next generation's going to be all right. It's so wonderful that even as, you know, to watch people, even as they reach these pinnacles in their career, like there's just this inherent desire to still give back and that's the heart of an empath, right? Is that you always, doesn't matter what I have, like I'm doing great, yay, but how can I get more people to enjoy this? How can I get more people to experience this? And that's such a necessary like thing in our world. And I also think it speaks to the core of what hospitality should be. It should be about creating welcoming spaces for people to experience. And so I am just so inspired by everything that you're doing.
I am so inspired by you.
Today. Oh, thank you. You know, it's funny, when I watched Psalm 3, I turned into you for a moment. Like some of the people that, some of the spaces I find myself in and people that I like know to talk to and stuff, I'm like you, like, how did I get here? Like,
what? Yeah.
I still feel that kind of overwhelming, sometimes almost impostery feelings, like, what the hell? And I think that's normal. I think that is normal as long as you don't hold on for it for too long and that you kind of shake those nerves off. And once you get into it, you realize, nope, I belong here. I'm cool with this. And that brings us to where you are today. You have been doing a ton of advocacy work and broadening the wine space with the Roots Fund and with so many other things since the events of last year took place. Tell us a little bit about the Roots Fund and CORE and all the other great things that you're doing.
Well, I mean, I will say I'm a really small part in those organizations. I'm there to offer any support and help that I can to Tahira, who is just one of the most amazing, inspiring, hardworking people I've ever met in my entire life. You know, we started talking about, I really started talking to Tahira and like really trying to figure out like what we could do better, what I could be doing better. You know, when she reached out to talk about her experience in the court, and it shook me, right? Like it was, there were things that I always knew that were, I had not experienced what Tahira experienced myself in the court, but it somehow, something in me wasn't surprised when I found out that she and so many other people had. And, you know, so I feel like I missed it. I was lucky, you know, to have sort of missed it, but I could definitely, it wasn't a surprise. And I could suddenly just like see, you know, all of the problems, you know, right away when she started talking. And so basically my role in all of this is to provide support in whatever way I can. I would love to be, I never thought of myself as a mentor in wine because I still feel like I'm constantly learning and like being mentored, you know, by Aldo, by Destin, by all of these amazing people. But what I've sort of started to realize is like, I do have kind of a lot of experience now that I like, it didn't occur to me that I might be helpful. And so to hear it was like, no, you'd be helpful.
You'd be really helpful.
Like, would you, you know? And so I would like very much to, I wanted very much to offer myself up in that way, to anybody who ever has questions or just wants to talk about their experiences or, you know, advice or whatever anybody needs that I can help with. I just want to be available for it. I feel like, you know, I didn't have mentors that, I didn't have people in the industry that like looked like me or, you know, in order to get, but I didn't believe at the time that it was like necessary in order for me to get where I got. It would have been, I think, you know, it would have been a lot easier and maybe more like I would have had like this, you know, position to kind of look up to, but I didn't have it myself. I'd like to be able to say that I can offer that to someone else. And so, you know, the work that Tahir has been doing in making the wine world a more open place, a place where people don't feel that intimidation around any part of it, not just in fine dining, but just like wine can be intimidating. And I just love how she's really doing a lot of work. And, you know, I'm trying to help in terms of like breaking down the snobbery around it, breaking down the gates, breaking down the idea that you have to be able to speak about it in a certain way. That's all nonsensical. It really goes back to what, you know, we were talking about initially is this is, we're here to like help people experience things, right? Like, how do we help people realize how joyful just the experience of having a great glass of wine can be with, and just forget all the other stuff around it. I feel that very deeply that like that the joy should be translated in such a way that is just universal. And so that I think the work to like get like almost pare it back down is harder than it might seem. But people are it's hard for people to just like be genuine about what they're feeling and what they're experiencing because all of these things have been built around it. So we're just like dismantling all of that to make it more welcoming for people to have their own authentic, joyful experiences.
Yeah. I mean, I try. It's why I describe the way wine the way I do a lot, where it's situational, right? I mean, for God's sakes, I like pairing Disney villains, right? Because we can talk about linear and angular wines with racing acidity. But if I just tell you, well, think about Jafar, right? suddenly you can personify this thing and it sort of makes sense, right? Or if I tell you Zinfandel, think of Ursula, that makes sense to a lot of people.
It really does. It really does.
And so I think that it's just like somebody's got to have, like someone's got to be a vessel for like translating it. But then once you've realized that you have enough to kind of translate it out to people, go share it in that way. You know, if you're not studying for something or you're not being asked to regurgitate information a certain way, you know, and I think that that's something that I've taken up in like changing the language of it. Okay, you are from South Asia. I'm from Central America and the Caribbean, right? If you describe something to me as spicy, I'm never going to think a jalapeno pepper because a jalapeno pepper is not spicy to me at all, right? If you describe something to me as sour and you say a green apple, that's not sour. If you say tamarind, tamarind is sour to me. So just, you know, like being more inclusive with the language that we use to understand that different people have different fruits, different spices, different everything around the world. So let's make the language that we're using universal, right? And I think that we all need to continue to work towards that because I love seeing new people. Like the best messages are, oh my God, I tried that wine that I saw you were talking about because you made it sound so good and I tasted it and it was great. Cool. Love it. Now keep drinking.
Love it.
Like that, that's all that matters. Now keep drinking. Now let's go to the next bottle. And that's what I think will keep, you know, it changes. It's turning a battleship. It's not, we're not going to just, you know, flip a switch and everything will be different. But I love the progress that we're making. I really, really do. And it is an honor and a pleasure to be able to learn and grow with people like you and so many others that we know that are more than willing and happy to share their knowledge. So you're not on the floor anymore, right? That day-to-day is gone, but you still drink wine. Tell us about something that you have recently had that is just good. And if, actually do that. What's a wine, a region, or a grape that you think people should be exploring, but it's not getting kind of the attention that it should?
Ooh, I don't know if it's not getting the kind of attention that it should, but maybe it's just in songs. I don't know. I know you were a big lover of Spain and like, you know, all the delicious stuff that's coming out, you know, from like sort of, you know, quote unquote, non-traditional regions. And I'm just like, I've had a little love affair with Spain and Spanish wine myself for like a couple years now, I think. And like to the point where like we poured Raul Perez, Ultrea Saint-Jacques, our wedding. Mm. Yeah. Like that was like my wedding. I love Mencia. I love Mencia. I think it's delicious. I think it's versatile. I think it's like, there's a couple producers that are just like making just, I mean, just fun wine. Like I love Raul Perez. I mean, that's geeky, but like everybody does. I love it. And I think, you know, one of the things that I really lead into like being off the floor and like not having to sort of describe wine in the same way all the time and really just like getting back to experiencing it is like, I've been rediscovering how good like lots of different Indian food is with wine. I mean, it's like one of those things that I was always frustrated by the fact that people were always like, oh, you can't have good wine with Indian food. You can't have, if you're going to have wine, it has to be sweet. Like, and I was like, how do you know? Like how much like Indian food have you had and how much wine have you tried with it? Like, why are you just saying this? And so like, I've been really enjoying like kind of eating like my food and my mom's food and like trying it with great wine. And you know what? Most of it's really good.
It's working.
It's working. That's been just like a fun, like personal, joyful experience for me. And a lot of like Spanish wines have been really kind of fitting that bill in terms of like great food pairings with like the kind of heavily like spice laden dishes that I'm used to eating.
Same. Oh my God. So guys,
we gotta cook we gotta cook together.
We have to. Once the world gets better, like guys, we've been telling you about Spain. Like, trust me on this country. These wines are phenomenal. This is just another, like, see, I'm gonna start collecting gold stars of other people that are championing Spanish wines. They are delicious. They are well-made. They are affordable. And even if you have one that you don't like, try it with a couple different things that you're eating. Like, there's a glass for every palate. This has been such a great conversation. So we always end with this little lightning round thing. All right, so quick answers. You can't think about it very much. First answer that comes to your head. Ready?
Okay.
If you are having a great day, everything has gone spectacularly well, you just want to celebrate, what do you drink?
Champagne.
Okay.
I know that's basic, but it's true.
No, it's not. There's never not a reason to drink champagne. On your worst day, everything went wrong. Like it was just, if it could go wrong, it did. Gosh, when is this going to be over? I just want to lay down. But first, a drink. What do you have?
Sherry.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I love Amontillado. That's probably what I reach for. If that's like my first drink, then I'm like, I got to take the edge off.
Some sherry.
Or Negroni.
Okay. Well, that answers the next one, because the next one was going to be, if you're not drinking wine, what's the cocktail or spirit that you love?
Oh, yeah, I'm reaching. Negroni or Boulevardier.
Okay. Those are two. I love that everyone loves these very spirit-forward cocktails. And last but not least... When someone tastes and has experienced as many wines as you, I often find there's something that just, it doesn't matter how much you have it, it's palatable and you can drink it, but it's just not one that does it for you. Is there a grape, wine, or region that you're just, you're not a lover of it?
Yeah, Tarantes. I've never gotten into it. Tarantes, sometimes like overly floral stuff. I just like, I'm not there. Yeah, that's probably it. It always, okay, I'll be honest. It's like the easiest one for me in blind tastings because I always am like, ah, lemon pledge. Yeah. Or like soap or something. But that's not very nice. I'm sure there's great Tarantes out there and I just like haven't had it.
That is fair, and fair. Oh my goodness, this has been such a great conversation. Tell people where they can follow you on social media.
Oh, my handle is at ESS_Thomas and at Kalamata's Kitchen.
Boom. Oh my God. Sarah, thank you so much for being here with us. This was a great conversation. And I can't wait to see your smile in person again and give you a big hug. And then we'll have to do a cooking video. Like,
yes.
Thank you
so much for having me. This has been so much fun. Definitely the best part of my day today.
Yay. Thank you. All right, guys. Well, until next week. Bye-bye. This episode was sponsored by Somm Merch. To get your Somm TV swag, make sure you visit shop.sommtv.com.